KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now.
It's not a gift to me, it's a gift to the Department of Defense.
Grifting and grifting? That's what anti-corruption experts are charging. Over reports, Qatar is preparing to give President Trump a $400 million luxury plane known as the Flying Palace.
Corruption is orders of magnitude worse than Trump won, which was already the worst in American history.
As President Trump lands in Saudi Arabia, then on to Qatar and the UAE, we'll speak with Robert Weissman of Public Citizen, the New York Times reporter Eric Lipton, who's exposed how Trump's two oldest sons are profiting from their dad's presidency, negotiating overseas deals worth billions of dollars. Then to Gaza, where Save the Children's warning every child is now at risk of famine due to Israel's 10-week-long blockade. We'll speak to an Oxfam representative in Gaza City, and then to Abu Bakr Abed, the 22-year-old Palestinian accidental war correspondent who we last spoke to in Gaza.
There's no food available. A lot of people are being taken to the hospital to receive treatment where doctors cannot really give the proper treatment for them, and the medications are not available. Israel has been blocking the two crossings, not allowing a trickle, a one single truck into Gaza. And that has really left people on the cusp of imminent death.
Today, Abu Bakr Abed joins us from Dublin, Ireland. His new piece for Dropsite is headlined, "The Unbearable Pain of Leaving Gaza." All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Israel's continuing its assault on the Gaza Strip, with at least 46 Palestinians killed and 73 wounded over the past 24 hours. Among the dead, at least two people killed when Israel bombed the Nasser Medical Complex in Khan Yunis. The strike killed photojournalist Hassan Islaya while he was receiving treatment for injuries he sustained in an airstrike last month. He's at least the 215th media worker killed in Gaza since October 2023. It's not the first time Israel's bombed Nasser Hospital. Israeli forces previously struck its emergency building, attacked tents for displaced people outside its gates, laid siege to the complex for over a week, and arrested scores of patients and medical staff. Since October 2023, Israeli forces have bombed or set fire to at least 35 hospitals across the Gaza Strip, each act a war crime. Many human rights groups and advocates charge under the 1949 Geneva Convention. On Monday, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for an end to Israel's total blockade of Gaza, in place since March 2nd, after a leading global hunger monitor said Gaza's entire population faces famine. This is UN spokesperson Stefan Dujarric.
Over 70 days into the blanket ban imposed by Israeli authorities on the entry of any supplies into Gaza, stocks have run out, bakeries have shut down, community kitchens are closing daily, and people are starving. This is not a natural disaster, but a human-made catastrophe that the world should not allow.
Hamas has released 21-year-old Israeli-American Eidan Alexander from captivity more than 580 days after the Israeli soldier was taken prisoner during Hamas's October 7, 2023 attack. Alexander reunited with his family in Israel Monday after the Trump administration secured his release in direct talks with Hamas. The deal was brokered by Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, sidelining Israeli negotiators who've refused to engage directly with Hamas over the remaining 21 captives still believed to be alive in Gaza. Hamas official called Alexander's release a goodwill gesture aimed at securing a new ceasefire with Israel ahead of Trump's trip to the Middle East, which he began today. President Trump was greeted by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as he landed in Riyadh today, the first stop on a tour of Gulf states that will also take him to Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. Trump's expected to discuss Iran's nuclear program, oil prices, and Gaza. He's also expected to focus on securing major investments with the three countries, which Trump claims could reach $1 trillion. This includes a reported arms deal with Saudi Arabia for more than $100 billion. Dozens of business leaders are in Riyadh for Trump's visit. Among them are billionaire CEOs Elon Musk and his brother, OpenAI's Sam Altman, BlackRock's Larry Fink, and Palantir's Alex Karp. Ahead of Trump's first major overseas trip, over 800 U.S. health workers called on Trump to demand a new ceasefire in Gaza and immediately allow aid to enter the Gaza Strip. The medical workers highlighted the increased risks to children, pregnant women, sick, and older Palestinians, whom they say are, quote, marching in an agonizing and cruel fashion toward death, unquote. The Department of Homeland Security said it's terminating temporary protected status, TPS, for thousands of Afghans living in the U.S. in just 2 months. DHS Secretary Kristi Noem cited the improved security situation in Afghanistan, but advocacy groups hit back at the suggestion it would be safe for Afghans to return, many of whom were granted TPS because they assisted U.S. forces during the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan. In related news, the Episcopal Church is ending a long-standing partnership with the federal government and refusing to help resettle white South Africans who've been granted refugee status in the U.S. The Episcopal Church cited its, quote, commitment to racial justice and reconciliation, unquote. Some 60 white South Africans arrived in the U.S. Monday as refugees, even though that program has been suspended for all other groups. President Trump said Monday he'll likely speak with Chinese President Xi Jinping in the coming days after the White House announced a deal to temporarily reduce Trump's tariffs on Chinese goods from 145% to 30%. The announcement set off a stock market rally on Monday led by tech stocks, including Amazon, Tesla, and Apple. Meanwhile, the Colombian president, Gustavo Petro, said Monday his nation will join the Belt and Road Initiative, China's massive global infrastructure development project. Petro spoke from the Great Wall of China ahead of a summit of Latin American and Caribbean leaders in Beijing. In an opening address earlier today, President Xi pledged lines of credit worth 66 billion yuan, equivalent to more than 9 billion U.S. dollars.
There are no winners in tariff wars and trade wars. Bullying and tyranny will only isolate oneself. China and Latin America and Caribbean countries are important members of the global South. Independence and self-reliance are our glorious traditions. Development and revitalization are our natural rights.
President Trump signed an executive order Monday directing U.S. drug makers to cut their prices by up to 80%, but the order doesn't include any enforcement mechanisms, and pharmaceutical stocks rose following the news and amidst relief within the industry. In a social media post, Trump invoked his most favored nation plan that he unsuccessfully tried to enact in his first term, which aims to bring U.S. drug prices in line with other wealthy countries. Vermont Independent Senator Bernie Sanders responded, quote, if Trump is serious about making real change rather than just issuing a press release, he'll support legislation I will soon be introducing to make sure we pay no more for prescription drugs than people in other major countries. If Republicans and Democrats come together on this legislation, we can get it passed in a few weeks, Sanders said. President Trump's fired the head of the U.S. Copyright Office, Shira Perlmutter. Her office had just released a report warning of the risks of using generative AI on copyrighted creative materials. Her firing comes just days after President Trump fired the woman who hired her, Librarian of Congress Carla Hayden. An outbreak of measles that began among unvaccinated people in Texas has grown to over 1,000 cases across 11 U.S. states. So far, three people have died of the vaccine-preventable disease, two children and an adult, with dozens more hospitalized. On Monday, Maryland Senator Angela Alsobrooks filed a no-confidence resolution calling on Health and Human Services Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. to resign, in part because of Kennedy's these repeated false claims about the safety and efficacy of vaccines. Also, Brooks filed the resolution after leading a rally Saturday of hundreds of protesters outside the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, many of them recently fired workers.
Since Donald Trump has taken office, NIH has fired 1,300 employees and canceled more than $2 billion in federal research grants. How awful, how shameful. And he wants to cut the NIH by another 40%. Please know that these cuts would be carried out under the ridiculous leadership of RFK Jr., our asinine HHS secretary.
Over the weekend, Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. revealed he took his grandchildren for a swim in Washington, D.C.'s Rock Creek, despite clear and longstanding public health warnings of high bacterial levels that make the waterway unsafe. California Governor Gavin Newsom is escalating his crackdown on the state's unhoused, again calling on California cities and counties to sweep and ban encampments. Governor Newsom said he's allocated $3.3 billion to help localities enact the ban.
It is time to take back the streets. It's time to take back the sidewalks. It's time to take these encampments and provide alternatives. And the state is giving you more resources than ever. And it's time, I think, to just end the excuses.
There are some 187,000 unhoused people in California, according to the latest data. Housing advocates warn criminalizing homelessness will only compound the issue and slam Governor Newsom for focusing on the failed model of forced drug and mental health treatment while failing to address the core issues of housing shortages and skyrocketing housing costs. And in Mexico, a mayoral candidate and four of her supporters were killed Sunday when shots rang out at a campaign rally in the eastern state of Veracruz. Yesenia Lara Gutierrez was running for mayor of Texistepec in Mexico's June 1st election as a member of the Morena Party. Witnesses reported hearing about 20 gunshots.
A very cruel injustice, right? Texistepec used to be peaceful. Now look at the result. So much injustice, so many killings.
Sunday's assassination came just 2 days after mass gunmen shot and killed Cecilia Rubalcaba, a municipal council member in Jalisco. Last year, political violence in Mexico surged to an all-time high, with human rights groups reporting 661 attacks on people and facilities. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Trump was greeted by Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman as he landed in Riyadh today on the first stop of his major trip of his second term. He'll then head to Qatar and the United Arab Emirates. Trump is pushing for Saudi Arabia to invest over $1 trillion in the United States and sign new arms deals. Executives traveling on the trip include the world's richest man and Trump advisor, Elon Musk, also his brother, BlackRock CEO Larry Fink, Citigroup CEO Jane Fraser, Palantir's Alex Karp, and OpenAI CEO Sam Altman. Ahead of the trip, President Trump confirmed reports that the royal family of Qatar may soon give him a $400 million luxury 747 plane known as the Flying Palace to temporarily replace Air Force One. ABC News reports the plane may be the most valuable gift ever given to the United States from a foreign government. According to multiple press reports, the plane would be initially given to the Air Force, which will need to spend millions to refurbish it. The plane will later be donated to President Trump's presidential library, meaning Trump could continue using the plane after he leaves office. On Monday, President Trump defended Qatar's offer.
It's not a gift to me. It's a gift to the Department of Defense.
We're joined now by Robert Weissman, co-president of Public Citizen. President Trump just said, Rob, this is not a gift to me. This is a gift to the Air Force. Your response?
Yeah, it's not a gift to the Air Force. It's not a gift to the American people. It's a very personal gift to Donald Trump designed, as everyone can see, to buy influence and ongoing access with the president of the world's most powerful nation. It is almost certainly the most corrupt deal in all of American history. Part of the plan, as you mentioned, is that he'll use it as Air Force One and then keep access to it after he leaves the presidency, which he is going to do at the end of this term, for his personal use. Never been anything like this before. It plays perfectly to Trump. It's not just a large gift. It is, as you said, described as a palace in the sky. So plays into his love for the ornate, the opulent, and the regal. And it is, to say it is unconstitutional is to understate the scale of this corruption.
Rob Weissman, if you can also talk about, I mean, it's $400 million so-called gift. But then the Air Force would have to pour in millions. Explain.
Right. Well, this is made to be a palace in the sky, but it's not made to be Air Force One. So all of the national security devices and protections that have to be built into the plane would have to be built into this so-called gift. So it's a huge waste of taxpayer assets. It's not clear how much time Trump would be able to use it while in the presidency. Reports are it would take years to do that upgrade. And by the time it's upgraded, it may be time to move on to the next president. So it is, for an administration that claims to care about efficiency, which is obviously a lie, this is yet another indication that that is just a nonsensical claim, a sop that they throw out there. It is the most wasteful and inefficient administration probably in American history. That this is a small piece of that, is a tiny part of this problem. The core problem here is the core corruption that this embodies, and it is fundamental to understanding what this Trump administration is all about.
It's a number of Republicans who are raising serious questions about this. You have Senator Hawley, who's saying, why can't this big, beautiful plane be from the United States? In fact, Trump worked a deal to get two Boeing planes. What's happened to them as Air Force One?
Right, so this actually is a Boeing plane, but it's owned by Qatar, which would then gift it to him. You're right that lots of Republicans, even they, are saying, hey, this is a step too far. Right-wing commentators like Laura Loomer and Ben Shapiro are denouncing, which gives you some indication of how outrageous it is. It is a direct violation of the U.S. Constitution's Emoluments Clause, which says the president cannot accept gifts from foreign nations. And it is also the case, as you said, that there already are more Boeings on the way. They are slow. Boeing is a company that is not doing well now and is messing this up, apparently, as it's messing up so much more. But it does take a long time to build Air Force One, in part because everyone who's even making a part for the plane is required to undergo a national security background. In the same way, it'll take a long time to upgrade this plane if, in fact, the gift is made to Donald Trump.
Qatar, dubbed indispensable for U.S. military operations, recently extended its defense cooperation agreement with Washington, yet signed a beachside villa resort deal with the Trump Organization. Can you talk about the significance of this deal, Rob?
Everything about the trip that Trump is on right now should be understood as about personal grift, first, and secondarily about potential U.S. interests. So Trump is accepting this plane. He and his family business are looking to make so-called investments in the UAE and Qatar. They're not really investments. They're just licensing deals where they're paid to let their name be plastered on golf courses and towers. He also has his cryptocurrency businesses and just accepted a deal that's going to purchase $2 billion of his crypto for no reason at all, except to gift some portion of that to Trump. So there's a lot of money flowing in to this presidency personally. The first Trump administration was the most corrupt in American history by far. What's going on now is literally orders of magnitude worse. You know, in the first administration, we were upset about the Trump Hotel and people in foreign governments taking out hotel rooms they didn't need at $800 or $1,200 a night. Now they're making deals for $400 million a pop. It is quite something, and it is both a degradation of the presidency, but more fundamentally, it's a corruption of the office, meaning foreign policy or policy in general is for sale in this administration. If you want to get an outcome, find a way to get some money directly to the president and his family, and you got a good chance to get what you want.
And very quickly, on the executive order he just signed before his trip to require drug companies to decrease their prices within 30 days, which sounds like a very good thing, make them so they're not more expensive drugs than in other parts of the world, you're contending he will just pick up the prices and this will benefit drug companies in the rest of the industrialized world.
Right. It's a good tagline. It would be a good policy if it were his policy. As you said, Bernie Sanders supports it. Public Citizen supports it. The idea that the U.S. shouldn't pay more for drugs than other rich countries around the world. Donald Trump could push that policy forward by supporting legislation in Congress, which would pass in no time if he said he supported it, or even using his own existing tools. He's not doing that. He just signed an executive order which said, please don't make us pay more, which no drug company is going to follow. But what he also said is the rest of the world should pay more to raise their prices to be more like the United States. So the practical impact of what he's going to do is going to be to raise prices overseas. Meanwhile, Republicans in Congress aren't trying to lower prices. They're trying to extend monopoly protections to make the prices paid by Medicare more expensive. So the drug companies are going to come out pretty well from this deal, even though they're pretty scared of what might happen. What seems to actually be happening is going to benefit their bottom line, hurt the rest of us.
Rob Weissman, I want to thank you for being with us, co-president of Public Citizen. Coming up, New York Times reporter Eric Lipton on how President Trump's two oldest sons, Don and Eric, are profiting from their father's presidency, negotiating overseas deals worth billions of dollars. Stay with us. Only by Deerhoof, performing in our Democracy Now! Studio. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Trump heads to the Middle East with a single goal, deals, deals, deals. That's the headline of a New York Times piece our next guest contributed to as he follows the dealings of the Trump administration. Eric Lipton is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter with the New York Times, where his latest pieces are headlined, Auction to Dine with Trump Creates Foreign Influence Opportunity, and Trump's Sons' Deals on Three Continents Directly Benefit the President. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Eric Lipton. Well, why don't you start there? We're looking at this first major international trip President Trump is taking. First stop, Riyadh. We're looking at the line of American CEOs and others who are shaking the hands of Mohammed bin Salman and President Trump, very prominently, of course, the richest man in the world, Elon Musk, the Trump ally. If you can talk about who is behind the trip? You can talk about the advising of Jared Kushner, his son-in-law, and what all of them, and who we aren't seeing right now, Eric and Donald Trump, have to gain.
Well, the Middle East is the nexus of the Trump organization's global business operations at the moment. It's really their single most important profit center by far. And it relates to the fact that there is such enormous wealth there. It's the oil and gas revenues over many decades have been stuffed into the sovereign wealth funds. And the sovereign wealth funds are now looking to expand their engagement globally to become more prominent economic players in the world. And so that's the reason that there are so many you know, venture capitalists and or you know, artificial intelligence or technology companies that are heading to the Middle East. And it's the same reason that the Trumps and Jared Kushner are so tied to the Middle East, because they have hundreds of billions of dollars to give out. And that's the reason that so many American corporations are in the Middle East with President Trump right now. So for the Trump family, they have $2 billion worth of capital that in the last several weeks, the government of Abu Dhabi announced that it was going to put into World Liberty Financial, their cryptocurrency company. And that will pass through World Liberty on its way to Binance, the largest crypto exchange in the world. But while that money resides with World Liberty, the Trump family and its partners will be making interest off of that $2 billion. So we're talking tens of millions of dollars a year. Similarly, and not very far away in Qatar, as your prior guest was referencing, the government there is the landowner on a property where the Trump family is going to be doing a golf and villas. And many of these projects in the Middle East are coordinated with a company called Dar Global, which is a subsidiary of Dar Al Arkan, which is a Saudi-based real estate company that's closely aligned with the government of Saudi Arabia. And Dar Global has six different real estate projects with the Trump family, which basically are branding projects where the Trump name is, as you know, Robert Wiseman indicated, is put on these projects. The Trumps get millions of dollars in branding fees, and then they often get licensing and managing fees as well. So they have projects in Saudi Arabia, in Oman, in the United Arab Emirates, with Dar Global. And that's where the biggest growth chunk of the Trump real estate operations are, through Dar Global and these branding projects. And so, you know, when I looked at the list of who's attending the Saudi meetings today, I didn't see anyone from Dar Global listed, although they may be there. And I didn't see their other business partners listed as being present. But just being in that space is good for the president being there, is good for Jared Kushner. Jared Kushner has more than $2 billion in funds from the Public Investment Fund of Saudi Arabia, which went into his private equity firm. And then similarly, the Public Investment Fund is the single biggest investor in LIV Golf, which has played four tournaments in a row at the Trump family's Doral golf course in Florida. And so the money from the Middle East is just in so many different ways, in crypto, in golf, and hotels, and Jared Kushner, are flowing into Trump family operations. And so it's not surprising that this is a big trip that the president has taken to visit UAE, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, three business partners of the Trump family.
So talk more about Eric and Donald Trump. In the first administration, we saw them all the time. They were front and center. But right now, we're not seeing them. You write an article, maybe that's because they're making deals on three continents that directly benefit the president, but also the financial relationship between President Trump and his two older sons.
I mean, Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner were in the White House in the first term, but Don Jr. and Eric Trump were never a part of the administration. They were part of the political operation, and they have always been a part of the political operation. So in terms of their visibility and presence in the second term, I don't see that much difference for Don Jr. and Eric. I mean, they are very active, and they are, you know, Eric Trump was just in Dubai giving a speech at the crypto event. And then he similarly was with Dar Global having a grand celebration of the start of the Dubai Trump International Hotel project that's on sale there now for, you know, more than, you know, I think it's $12 million for some of the top condos there. So there, and, you know, Don Jr. is going to be in Vegas for a Bitcoin conference, and he's going to be in Qatar next week as well for another conference. And so they are out there, and Don Jr. is opening up a new club in Washington. He's a part owner of something called the Executive Branch, which is, you know, obviously named after the White House, that's paying, you know, you're going to cost you $500,000 a person to get a membership. And David Sachs, the president's crypto advisor, is one of the founding members. And Jeff Miller, a lobbyist who has dozens of clients that he's gotten since Trump started, he's a big fundraiser for Trump, is also one of the founding members. And Don Jr., the son of the president, is one of the owners. So Don will be present at that venue in Georgetown once it opens. So I've seen a lot of Don and Eric, similar to what I saw in the first term. The difference is that they are much bolder in their deal making right now than they were in Trump's first term, where they were a little more shy about pursuing profits as aggressively as they now are. There's very little restraint at the moment. They're just pursuing as many profitable deals as they can find.
If you can talk more about cryptocurrency, and I think there's a problem in the United States, a lot of people don't even understand what it is. But earlier this month, the founder of the Trump family's cryptocurrency venture said Thursday that a fund backed by Abu Dhabi will make a $2 billion investment in the crypto exchange, you pronounce it Binance. Talk more about that and how exactly President Trump is financially benefiting from this.
Yeah, so there are at least three different ventures, and you could argue that there are four that the Trump family has recently embraced relative to crypto. There's the meme coin, which is one that the president is having the auction that ended yesterday in order to, the more of his meme coin that you buy, the you can get invited to a dinner and even a tour of the White House. And that is personally enriching him and his sons. And there are 220 people that are next Thursday will be invited to the Trump National Golf Course in Virginia for a dinner with Trump. And 25 of them will have a, quote, VIP reception with him. And then that similar 25 will also be invited for a White House tour. And that's because they spent, you know, in some cases, millions of dollars to buy the Trump family's cryptocurrency meme coin, directly enriching the president and his family in exchange for getting access to the president. So again, we, you know, in history, if you make campaign contributions, you get access to powerful people. We've not had a tradition in the United States where if you personally enrich a person, that, you know, the president or a US senator, that if you give money to the US senator, that you then can have a meeting with the US senator, that are the, or with the president of the United States. That is not the tradition in the United States, but that has now become what Trump is doing. So that's one company, that's the meme coin. It's a dollar sign TRUMP, all caps. And the second company is World Liberty Financial. And that one is they're trying to be effectively a JP Morgan Chase of the crypto world. They're gonna have, you know, lending and borrowing, you know, borrowing money and depositing your crypto in their accounts. They also have something called a stable coin where you can deposit your crypto and it will be maintained a dollar to dollar value for each stable coin. And that's the place where the Abu Dhabi, which is a part of the UAE, has put $2 billion. So overnight, that World Liberty went from becoming just started in October to now having the one of the largest stablecoin deposit in the world. It's one of the, and stablecoins are one of the most profitable chunks of the crypto world, because what happens is that $2 billion that the government of Abu Dhabi has put into World Liberty, much of that will be put into short-term treasuries to try to back up the dollar to dollar stablecoin. And the yield from those treasuries will go, the interest, the return on that investment goes to World Liberty, not to the owner of the stable coins. And so that's why it's so profitable. Tether, which is the world's largest stable coin producer, makes billions of dollars in yield and taking that yield from people who deposited stable coins. So that's a second venture. The third one is that just yesterday, Eric Trump announced that they're gonna have a publicly traded Bitcoin mining company, which they are executives on. And the fourth, with Trump Media and Truth Social, they're also talking about having some crypto nexus, although it is, that one's a little less clear. So the family is rushing into crypto because they see it as a potential profit center, and it is quickly emerging as one of the single biggest, if not the single biggest, sources of revenues and profits for the Trump family. And this is happening at the same time as the president appoints the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, which has been rolling back all kinds of regulatory enforcement actions of crypto, including partners of the Trump family have been given regulatory relief, and even one, the president himself pardoned Arthur Hayes, who is effectively a business partner of World Liberty Financial. So the president effectively pardoned a business partner. Again, it's like, it's never happened before. And the Justice Department is rolling back its own crypto enforcement program. And so at the same time as Trump is the chief regulator, he is also the regulated, and he's curbing the regulations in a way that directly benefits his own business operations. These are conflicts on a scale that we've never seen before in American history. And they're playing out so quickly and at such a complex level that most of the American public just simply cannot follow it all. And to throw in a 747 being donated by the government of Qatar, I mean, it's just headline after headline, they're happening just day after day.
So finally, Eric Lipton, you're an investigative reporter. You focus on powerful people and the influence they have over American society and the world. You've been a reporter for more than three decades. Your work has received three Pulitzer Prizes. What has surprised you most in reporting on the Trump administration and this whole pay-to-play approach of the presidency so far?
It's just how unrestrained it is. During the first term, they were reluctant to be so brazen. They tried to appear to be more respectful to conflict of interest and norms and standards. And I think that, and I've talked to Eric Trump about this, because Eric Trump and I have had a very respectful relationship for over a decade now. We've had lunch. He was angry over how they were treated in the first term, and he felt, and they were subpoenaed, they were sued, and he felt, his feeling was, we tried to be good. Now, obviously most of your viewers would think that they weren't good, but they did at least make an attempt to, for example, they did not do new international real estate deals during the first term. And his feeling is, we tried, and we were still completely assaulted with lawsuits and subpoenas. And so coming into the second term, they said, we're going to act ethically. They feel like they're acting ethically. You can argue over that, but we're going to do what we want to do. We're not going to be restrained by appearances, and they're not restrained. And that's the thing that's most striking and startling, is it just how completely unrestrained this is. And the conflicts of interest, it's no longer an appearance of a conflict of interest. These are real, provable conflicts of interest. And many people want to use the word corruption. I'm more reluctant to use that term. I mean, there are ethical violations everywhere that we're seeing. There are conflicts of interest. There is an appearance of corruption. To me, corruption means when you're giving someone in exchange for a benefit, and that's the quid pro quo part of that appears to be the case, but proving that is something that generally I want to let a court, our prosecutor document the quid pro quo. We have all the ingredients of the quid pro quo, but whether or not there was intent to give a government benefit in exchange for financial assistance is something that is is subjective. But all the ingredients are now there in a way that is so brazen, striking, and unprecedented in American history. It's really sort of shocking. And that's the thing that's most surprising to me.
Eric Lipton, I want to thank you for being with us. Three-time Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, investigative reporter at The New York Times. We'll link to your latest pieces at democracynow.org. When we come back, we go to Gaza, where Save the Children's warning every child is now at risk of famine, at risk of starvation, due to Israel's 10-week-long blockade. We'll speak with one of the leaders of Oxfam in Gaza City. And then we'll go to Abu Bakr Abed, 22-year-old Palestinian accidental war correspondent. We spoke to him when he was suffering from malnutrition in Gaza. He's now in Ireland. Stay with us.
He was her only child, her baby boy. She was his second daughter, her father's pride and joy. Somebody's mother, brother, best friend, sister, lover, maybe an A1 student running, hiding, taking cover. The women gather crying, tears that fill a million oceans. It doesn't matter where you live.
Women Gather by Sweet Honey and the Rock, performing in our Democracy Now! Firehouse studio over 20 years ago. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. On Monday, the United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres called for an end to Israel's total blockade of Gaza, which is now in its third month. A new UN report warns one of every five people in Gaza is facing starvation, as, quote, goods indispensable for people's survival are either depleted or expected to run out, unquote. Save the Children's warning, every child in Gaza is now at risk of famine. Earlier this month, the World Central Kitchen announced it can no longer prepare and distribute food in Gaza since they've run out of supplies. This is Amna Rizk, a mother of six in Jabalia in Gaza.
All day on one piece of bread, I swear. One piece. We eat one meal. All of us, the elderly, the young, we're all living on one piece of bread. We divide it among ourselves. We divide one piece of bread, I swear. What can we do?
For more, we go to Gaza City, where we're joined by Mahmoud Al-Sakha, Oxfam's food security and livelihoods coordinator. Welcome to Democracy Now! Thank you for joining us from Gaza. Explain the effects of the Israeli blockade on Gaza right now.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. As you already mentioned, the Israeli authorities now imposing this complete blockade for all the supplies into Gaza since more than 70 days. So we are talking about no any humanitarian or commercial, no food, no medical supplies are entered since the 2nd of March. And also the nutrient supplements and the therapeutic food for the treatment of malnutrition also is forbidden. Our supplies as organizations, as humanitarian organizations, and also other like-minded organizations, supplies have been depleted. So the situation on the ground here is becoming unbearable, to be honest. And also the families have been exhausted, all kinds of coping mechanisms. We are seeing that the stocks are depleted and also observing this worsening public health situation in the overcrowded makeshift camps and locations where the people are sites. Just yesterday, an important report have been issued, which is it's measuring the food insecurity of the people and also the malnutrition. This report is also mainly confirming what we have already repeatedly during the last days, that there is a warning of the situation in the Gaza Strip, where they are saying that the whole population continues to face this critical risk of famine, and also half a million people are starving in Gaza Strip. When we are talking about starving, we are talking about they are facing a catastrophic food insecurity situation. That means that they have an extreme lack of access for food, and there's an malnutrition rates are increasing, and also we are expecting this due to this starvation and diseases outbreaks. So this is just a glimpse about the current situation on the ground here in Gaza.
Is there any safe water, drinking water in Gaza?
Same. You know that more than 90% of the Gazans are classified as water insecure. And nowadays they are using mostly unsafe water sources. So this is why we are saying that there is a rapid deterioration of the public health. And this deterioration in the public health is also affecting and leading to the outbreaks, to the malnutrition among the children and also the pregnant and lactating women. All these things together, the clean water and also the solid waste system that it's almost collapsed, and the overcrowding in the makeshift camps and the displaced locations are worsening the health conditions and increasing the morbidity among the children and adults.
You've said that Oxfam is witnessing scenes that, quote, defy belief, families wasting away from hunger, malnourished children too weak to cry, an entire community surviving without food or clean water. Describe these scenes on the ground.
Yeah. As I said, you know, now the only lifeline for food assistance in Gaza Strip is the community kitchens. And so far, more than 50% of these community kitchens have been shut down because of the lack of supplies. So we are talking about the severe shortages of the food supplies. Nowadays, the people didn't even manage to have one meal per day. So what we are seeing on the ground here, because of this severity of the crisis, people are enforcing to feed their children with a flour that is spoiled or infested, simply because they didn't have an alternative. You know that they enforced to do so, and also at the same time, and also we are seeing the people for many days didn't even got the chance to get bread. And the people, the adults and the breadwinner of the family are just crying because he cannot feed his children. You can imagine that this is the situation. And the fundamental question that we are receiving from all those people, to be honest and to be frank in that regards, are even on the same, they are repeating, are our lives and our children's lives are truly worthless for the world? And are we really mean nothing? Because such scenes, to be honest, and even the situation on the ground, it's much more than what we are seeing in the pictures or the scenes and the images. The situations, we are not exaggerating when we are talking about catastrophic situations. People are starving to death, and this is not, this is a fact that we are witnessing and experiencing nowadays.
You've said Gaza's starvation is not incidental. It's deliberate, entirely engineered, has now created the largest population facing starvation anywhere in the world. Talk about what you're calling for, what Oxfam is calling for, and also respond to the U.S. confirming that they're calling for a new system for providing humanitarian aid to Palestinians in Gaza through private companies, even as Israel's blockade continues.
You know, this proposal and this mechanism that we are talking about is contravenes the humanitarian principles, and it's not practical or feasible, by the way. And they are intending to support or serve about 60% of the population in the Gaza Strip. And they are going to serve them with just talking about food and some other basic items. But the Palestinians in Gaza Strip are need in much more issues. Also, one of the issues is that the issue of that they are enforcing civilians to walk for a long distances in order to get their supplies from specific locations or hubs. And we have a lot of elderly people and people with disabilities, a lot of funded people, so they are not, cannot do that. You are saying that, and I'm insisting that we are in the middle of the starvation, and we are just discussing such a mechanisms. At the same time, we have humanitarian aid organizations who have rigorous systems on place, and for the last more than 16 months, they are supporting the community. So what is needed is just to open the borders and to allow us to operate freely so we can support those people who are in desperate need. We are discussing this while the people are starving, and there are a lot and hundreds, thousands of trucks are stuck on the borders, just need a green light to enter so we can fulfill our mandate and to support the people who are in need. To be honest, we, as a humanitarian workers and as employees working on that sector, we are feel tired, disappointed, and also frustrated that we cannot even support the people. Our supplies in Oxfam has been ended since 1 month, and we cannot provide any food assistance for any of the people here because our stocks has been depleted and our warehouses are empty. So we cannot support the people who are starving and who are in a desperate need. All that we need is to get our supplies in, is to have this ceasefire, is to stop these hostilities, to allow us to work freely and to be protected in that regards.
Do you concur with what Al Jazeera is saying, that authorities in Gaza said that at least 57 people starved to death as a result of the Israeli blockade?
This is in fact the accumulative number of the people death because of malnutrition. During this crisis, after the resumption of the hostilities, we have at least one confirmed cases that have been dead due to the malnutrition. But you know, the issue of the malnutrition, that it's now we are expecting the deterioration become more rapidly, because from our experience, acute malnutrition can worsen rapidly. Now we didn't have any supplies in the local market, so we are expecting the worst. And the worst is coming day by day, not even through weeks or months. So we're expecting a critical levels of malnutrition in the coming few days, if no any action is taken in that regards.
Mahmoud Al-Saqa, I want to thank you for joining us and again say that Israel prevents all international journalists from entering Gaza, and that over 200 journalists have been killed in Gaza in the Israeli strikes, not to mention the number of health workers, medical workers. Mahmoud Al-Saqa, I want to thank you for being with us, Oxfam's Food Security and Livelihoods Coordinator, speaking to us from Gaza City. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. We go from Gaza to someone who was just in Gaza when we last spoke to him. Abubakar Abed is a 22-year-old journalist from Deir al-Balah. He used to be a footballer, soccer commentator, but now, as he says, he's an accidental war correspondent. In recent weeks, he's been evacuated to Dublin, Ireland, to continue his education and get medical treatment for malnutrition. He received a scholarship to study as he heals. His new piece for Drop Site News is headlined The Unbearable Pain of Leaving Gaza. Abu Bakr, welcome back to Democracy Now! We last spoke to you in Gaza. Now you're in Dublin. Talk about that journey that you took and your thoughts as you listen to another report from Gaza City, a report that you might have given several months ago.
Yeah, thank you so much, Amy, for having me. Of course, it's been a very agonizing decision, a very heartbreaking one. And let me just say first that everyone in Gaza should have this chance to get the treatment. Everyone in Gaza should have the right to continue their education. I'm not better than anyone inside Gaza at the moment. But yes, for a 22-year-old to take such a decision at such a time in a very, very young age is absolutely traumatizing. I was forced to it because at that time I was very malnourished, and if I stayed because of the blockade, and we heard the report and the ongoing starvation blockade of every corner of the Gaza Strip, is just lethal. So if I stayed, I would die. All Gaza right now is starving. So I was left with no choice. And this wasn't the only reason, to be honest, because at the same time, it was threatened multiple times. Yesterday, Israeli warplanes bombed the Burns ward inside the hospital, killing journalist Hassan Slayer. He's literally the most famous, renowned journalist inside Gaza. Everyone really learned from him. I learned from him. And he brought journalism to Gaza. He's been covering Gaza since 2009, 3 years after the blockade or the siege that Israel imposed on the territory. So when you look at the number of journalists killed in Gaza, more than 215, and I'm very unfortunate to have survived. But again, everyone deserves this chance. Everyone should have the right to education, to health, to everything. But I can't really tell you that I'm safe here. I'm probably a physical survivor, but not an emotional survivor. The images that I took with me from Gaza are still haunting me all the night. And I can tell you, like, over the past 3 weeks since arriving here, many nights I didn't sleep at all, because every place, every beautiful place I visited here in Dublin or around Ireland, I had that secondary instant idea that this place would be bombed and I would see it lying in ruins, even the home where I'm residing right now. So the trauma is relentless, and my whole family is still in Gaza, my friends, my colleagues, and all of them. I'm just thinking about them every single second all day. And this shouldn't be, again, this shouldn't be the life of a 22-year-old. And I didn't want to make this decision. I wanted to stay. But when a son hears from his mom that, telling him that he is going to harm his own family and harm her, your home country is no longer your home. You have to flee, you have to leave, because your mom thinks you are a danger, your family thinks you're a danger, and everyone felt that I was going to be the next target. And myself, I knew that I was going to be the next target. So when you're put under such circumstances, this is just an unfair word and filled with corruption that no one can really describe. So this is just a very traumatizing and agonizing decision, and I don't know what to say anymore.
If you can talk about what it is like to watch the news outside about what's happening inside, and what is happening directly to your family inside now, though you have made it out, Abu Bakr?
It's unfair, it's traumatizing, and I constantly live in fear just thinking about my family. I try to have some joy here, but it's painful joy. I don't have a taste of any food. I don't have a taste to the pure water that I drink right now. I remember the times when I was in Gaza, I was drinking contaminated water coming from the sewage, and it was really causing me a lot of pain. But right now, even when you think about it, that someone has been taken from hell to heaven, it's really hard to process. And, you know, I'm not there anymore. So if I don't know, but if anyone, like, for example, I should have been today with the other journalists, mourned the death of our colleague, our brave colleague, Hassan Slayer, who was deliberately assassinated by Israel. And the killing spree continues to grow every single day towards journalists. So I should have been there, but I'm watching right now in silence, surrounded by fear, by fury, by wrath. I really want to do something, and I'm trying to do something from here to try and tell the governments, to the people, that we need to do something, because this is not, I mean, this is not some sort of aberration. This is deliberate genocide, starvation by design, an act to try and wipe out the entire Gazan population from the young to the elderly, because we've seen the systematic rage of entire families in Gaza. More than 1,200 families have been wiped out. And 1 week before leaving Gaza, my aunt's family was bombed. And my cousin, who was 45 years old, her husband was killed, she was killed, and all of her 60 children. So all of the family was wiped out. Now, their memories, their home, everything about them has now been is now erased because of Israel. So Israel continues bombing Palestinians. I can't really, I'm praying every single day that a ceasefire would be achieved, an agreement would be hashed out, but I'm trying to do something from here, but I can't tell you anything, but I feel very guilty for the water that I drink, for the fresh food that I have, for the good medications. Even I'm taking right now gastro-resistant pills and paracetamols and just other multivitamins these are just simple medications that I should have had in Gaza. But right now I'm taking these simple medications that I was forced to get out just to continue my education and take these medications, very simple medications. So what is the objective that Israel is trying to achieve by blocking the entry of aid, food and medications into Gaza? This is just the peak of terrorism that Israel is doing, and the hell that Israel has inflicted upon Palestinians, particularly the children, given the fact that half the population is the children. This hell is just unprecedented in the conditions. As I'm talking to my family and I'm hearing the bombings from abroad, I was hearing them in Gaza. I feel very frightened, very terrified, and I can't really have a good moment of safety here. I'm not safe. I'm just a physical survivor.
Finally, I'm speaking to you as President Trump is in his first major international trip. It's to Saudi Arabia. It's to United Arab Emirates. It's to Qatar. Qatar, which has been a country that is negotiating supposedly a deal between Hamas and Israel, of course, with U.S. involvement. What message do you have to these countries?
That is enough. It's enough. We're not a party to this war. And this is something I told you while I was in Gaza. We're not a party to this war. We didn't do anything to be suffering that way, that all the Palestinians right now trapped in the territory are still suffering every single day. They don't have access to water. They don't have access to food. My family is suffering relentlessly. They don't have anything. And that this, what is happening, is something that has to stop, because we are humans like anyone across the globe, and we have the right to live. We have the right to have a normal life, because the simplest things here in this country, in Ireland, are not available for people in Gaza. I'm seeing the leftovers people leave in the waste baskets. Those things are precious for Palestinians, for my family, for everyone in Gaza. But you can see the different worlds that we are living in. A whole community, a whole population is being genocided live now, while an entire world of 9 billion people is just to stand by passively, not being able to send one bottle of water or a can of food to children who are starving, who are being brutalized, traumatized, and ostracized as if their lives have no value at all.
Abu
and Israel's
Bakr
war crimes go just unpunished.